live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by John McCarron, Mike Miller, Mike Puente, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to go to our website and listen to any past broadcast, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, our Twitter handle is @Dumo. And if you've been listening to the program the last several weeks, we've been taking more email and tweets to us, and we will include that in our conversation. And I'm happy to report that the dispute between Comcast and AT&T is over. Our phones allegedly are working tonight, and you could be the very first person to test the new phone system if you give us a call. Again, 1-800-723-8289. Lots of busy week in politics, and I want to begin with one of the big stories, and that is the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has said he now wants to sue the President of the United States. And he said this earlier this week. He said, "The Constitution makes it clear that a president's job is to faithfully execute the laws. In my view, the president has not faithfully executed the laws. And when there's a conflict like this between the legislative branch and the administrative branch, it's, in my view, our responsibility to stand up for this institution in which we serve," Speaker of the House John Boehner. One of our Republicans is Chris Roebling. Chris, is this about style? Is it about substance? Or is it a stunt?
Oh, this is very serious. It is very substantial, and it is calling out the president and the administration for being the most lawless administration in United States history. There is no administration that comes close to Obama's utter disdain for the rule of law. 13 unanimous Supreme Court of the United States decisions against the administration, 34 groundless, baseless changes to the Affordable Care Act. This has got to be stopped.
John McCarron joins us, one of our Democrats.
Well, let me just second Chris Roebling by saying it's a bald-faced political stunt. There's no merit to it whatsoever. And as a city editor at the Chicago Tribune once told me when I was a young snot-nosed reporter, he says, you know, anybody can file a lawsuit.
So you don't buy any point that Chris just made?
Basically, no. These things can be litigated. I mean, we've just seen, and I think we're going to talk about later in the show, a number of constitutional and matters that get litigated, but it doesn't require the Speaker of the House of Representatives to call a press conference and make a big deal out of, a broad accusation, which I think is, by and large, doesn't hold water.
Mike Miller of DePaul University joins us.
Even if he gets the lawsuit put before the courts, it probably would not be adjudicated till after Obama's out of office. But I'm floored that you don't believe for a second that this man has violated the law, has gone beyond his ability, his rights as president. I don't care if it was a Republican or a Democrat. I would be screaming, as I've done on this show many times, every time during the Obamacare.
Mike Puente joins us. First time. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Reporter for WBEZ, the public radio station in Chicago. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Your response.
Well, I think for the public, it's going to be more gridlock, just more gridlock in Washington, not focusing on the economy, not focusing on things that the American public wants to see done. Yes, it's a serious issue, but at the same time, for folks who are struggling out there, it's just kind of more the same in Washington.
I wonder if the two sides would agree, Chris and John, if you would agree that one aspect of this, and maybe one very important aspect of it, is for each of the sides here, it's to gin up the base. Boehner going out and suing the President of the United States, that's going to play real well in a lot of congressional districts around the United States. And yet the President can say it's those Republicans again, they're politicizing everything. And many of the things that he has done with his executive orders are pleasing to Democratic constituency groups, and they'll say, right on, we don't care about this Constitution thing, you're helping us out.
I completely disagree. I don't think that the base – I I think that Mike's point about the way regular people will view this is the answer to your question. And here's what I mean by that. Folks are going to see this as inside baseball, Washington back and forth. They're not, people do not live their lives on the question of structural federalism
right.
versus the, you know, co-equal branches. That's not the basic daily lived reality.
But if a president, if a president says that we're going to stop deportations, I mean, something that a lot of Hispanics would like, and a lot of those are Democrats.
Let me tell you, this is, there are very substantial constitutional issues that are presented in this question, and that has to be adjudicated because it is impossible on the, you know, normal application of the political question doctrine is let the Congress work it out. The Senate has basically taken the last several years off. They're not producing any legislation. They're not going to conference. They're not negotiating with the House. And that's why you've got this impasse.
John McCarron.
I guess the Senate is supposed to tee up things for the House to knock down in Chris's view. But I, to get back to your premise, are these guys playing politics? Yeah. And lest I come across as too partisan.
Both sides.
Lest I come across as too partisan, so is the president. I mean, this stuff about the war on women. I'm sorry, but I mean that's going for the base, as is a lot of the equality but discrimination against gays and what that's base work. I mean that's where he's playing.
Mike,
would you accept, John, that much of this comes back to the fact that the president is incapable of reaching from the presidency to the Congress to try to make deals the way that
Reagan and Tip O'Neill did, because he's
incapable.
The leader of the Senate, the gentleman, I think he just survived a primary. He said going in, the main objective of the Republicans in Washington for the next 4 years is going to be make sure this guy doesn't get reelected. Well, he lost that. But I mean, when the leadership says, hey, this is what it's all about, we're going to get out of bed every morning and try to make Barack Obama look like a fool.
You heard that before, though.
Wasn't George Mitchell out there trying to make sure that George H.W. Bush was a one-termer? And he succeeded, okay? And I want to say, when you decry the idea of House members, or for that matter, senators, okay, members of the legislative branch, petitioning the courts on behalf of some principle about what the executive branch has done. As a college kid in Washington, I remember 50 press conferences led by Elizabeth Holtzman, led by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, led by Bella Abzug, with lawsuits against Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. lawsuits against Gerald R. Ford, decrying American foreign policy, decrying American domestic policy. That I don't understand why the mere fact that they're filing a lawsuit disqualifies this from any sort of substantial consideration.
I want to get reaction. 1-800-723-8029, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border. Nice to have you with us tonight. We'll take your calls and, again, your tweets at Dumo, or if you want to email us a comment, BruceDumont@museum.tv. Back shortly from Chicago. Went back in Chicago. Let's go to calls. Don is listening to us in Crown Point, Indiana, on our flagship station, WLS. Crown Point, Indiana, the town that John Dillinger put on the map. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce, and to your panel. To the gentleman who was the Democrat on the program.
Yes.
Where he said President Obama is not exceeding his authority under the Separation of Powers Act. I always thought that once a law is passed, nobody can change it unless Congress approves change. Yet he's changed the Affordable Health Care Act 62 times. He's also sent messages to Mr. Eric Holder to ignore laws that are already on the books. Since when is this not overstating his executive office powers?
John McCarron.
Well, I got to say, I'm not as familiar perhaps with you as of some of those incidents, but I would say that it would be impossible for the government to function if Congress had to sign on to everything.
I don't get
but
that.
But the point here is not Congress signing on to everything. No. It's not disrespecting the executive and the executive's authority. It is seeking legal basis for these completely off-the-wall changes that Obama has made. When the law says, when the law that's passed by Congress says the employer mandate will take effect as of, you know, the 5th of June, 2014, and that's in the law. That's the black letter law. If you're president, if you're President John McCain, you can't go in there and say.
And you can't run any kind of program if you've got to go back to. I mean, Chris, we've got 30 ambassadorial appointments that are being held hostage, 19 of which are career State Department.
Welcome to the life of George Bush. John Bolton was never a president.
So you're saying shut it all down? Shut it all down?
Of course not.
But in this
Congress micromanage the Affordable Care Act?
43. Three presidents before him were able to operate the federal government. What is it about this one that finds it impossible to operate his own signature legislation?
You also have this week, I want to talk about some of the Supreme Court decisions. You have a Supreme Court decision, a majority decision, a unanimous decision, including the appointees by President Obama, that said that President Obama overstepped his boundaries on the recess appointments.
Yeah, so, he decided what the Senate was in and not in session.
Right.
How preposterous.
What was the most significant of the Supreme Court decisions that will have the most lasting impact on the average citizen?
Wow, that's a tough call. Because they all have little pieces to them that are interesting, just like the recess appointments. That way you can't have the president deciding what the Senate is doing. The Senate is there. The Senate can have meetings.
What about the cell phone decision?
Yeah, I was in favor of what they did. I mean, that is – I have one in my pocket right here. It's turned off. And that's my personal property. Those are my papers, just like papers are at home. And that's protected by the Fourth Amendment.
Mike Pointy.
Oh, absolutely. If you're stopped by a police officer for anything and they're going through your personal belongings, including a cell phone, we know we have a whole bunch of apps and links or whatever, and maybe some of them are things – that are very private, bank information to just private information. Cell phones are no longer just cell phones. We actually don't use them too much as cell phones. They're just these personal.
Every picture, issues. Right?
Yeah, right.
So as Justice Robert said, I mean, it really creates a montage, literally a print of everyone's interests in life, and it should be protected. And obviously, the extension of that is laptops and iPads and everything else, so that those that again in this era when many people are concerned about privacy, that becomes an important decision.
Isn't John, you're astounding that there's 13 rulings. 9-0 on this particular Supreme Court that is so divided, where the president was on the wrong side of all 13 rulings. This tells me something, that the guy is not in the mainstream. He's the problem.
John, what about that? He's a constitutional lawyer.
No.
Professor.
Back to your cell phone thing. I'm a law and order Democrat, but I think unless there's probable cause that the cell phone had something immediately to do with the crime that was just committed, like the guys arranging a drug deal when the cops pull over the car, then I think probably they have no business going through who he's calling and whatnot.
Well, but the fundamental theme, I think, of this week is that Obama is not coping. Obama is not coping, whether it's the kids on the southern border, whether it's what's happening in Syria. We now, this is Sunday afternoon, and on this day, a caliphate was announced in western Iraq and eastern Syria. So they've declared themselves to be a caliphate. I remember 5 years ago, I mentioned the word caliphate to a bunch of Democrat friends of mine as a concern about what might happen in the Middle East. And they said it was warmongering, neocon, you know.
Do you think, though, that George Bush knew what a Sunni was or what a Shiite
absolutely.
Was before he was
absolutely.
Elected president of the United
sure.
States?
Of course.
I mean, strongly
well,
doubt that.
Even if
Chris.
He didn't, what he difference
said,
does
he
it
said before he was elected president?
Absolutely.
Shot at George Bush. Where'd that come from?
To borrow Hillary Clinton, what difference does that make now? The point here is that Obama's had 5 years on the economy, and we lost ground this week on the first quarter growth in the economy, an extraordinary drop in economic activity in the first quarter. So even if you just go to the very basic bread and butter issues of how's the economy doing, I think folks, you can't blame today's economy on George Bush anymore.
Chris, what do you think was the most significant decision last week, the longest lasting decision?
Well, I guess the longest lasting is going to probably be the evolution in the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, because we're going to be dealing with the sort of breakdown of privacy due to digitization of our records for the rest of everybody's life.
Right.
So I guess in that sense, the court's been dealing with this evolving line of how do you deal with the Fourth Amendment in a digital world. I think, though, that
there's probably going to be a good number of people who are currently in prison that will have a case to get out of prison.
I don't know the technicalities on that, but I also want to say the recess appointments, 9-0 on recess appointments. Here 9-0. Again, 43 prison.
The thing about several of these decisions is they didn't go all. I mean, the one way they got unanimous opinions was to sort of give half a loaf to each side. They said, yeah, you can have recess appointments, but they have to be, 10, 20 days long? The recess has to be. It can't be taking a lunch break.
If the New York Times calls it a stunning rebuke to the White House and the president.
I didn't know you were a fan.
It's right here on my iPhone. Come on.
Conservatives in recent weeks have been quoting the New York Times when they've bashed the president.
I'm quoting it to show John that this isn't just a Tea Party interpretation.
Editorially, there's incompetence on foreign affairs. Let's go to Michael listening to us on WLS in Chicago. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, well, some of the, at least half of your panel there bashes Obama. I would like to remind 52 straight months of job growth. For a socialist communist, this Dow hit an all-time record
for
Obama.
Stock market at record levels.
Yeah. That's great for the big cats who are, the fat cats
who
are not.
Nice. That's your base.
Hey,
come on.
Hey, I'm an economist, and I'll tell you that in this recovery and expansion, it is the weakest on record ever. And during this expansion, the economy has declined in two separate quarters, one in the first quarter of 11 and just the first quarter of 2014. This has never happened in an expansion before since the end of the Depression.
Let's let Michael respond.
Losses a month under W.
Michael, I want to say to you this. You are going to talk about job growth and every job that is created. God bless them. And that's
absolutely
great news for that family and that individual. No question about it. But I'm going to tell you, every job that has been created is up against somebody who has given up on looking for jobs, who has left the workforce, so that we've got the worst participation rate in the workforce since I got out of high school, which unfortunately is a long time ago. So I don't want you to go around crowing about job creation.
Go ahead, Michael.
How about 10 million Americans getting access to life-saving health care?
Well,
is that socialism, or is that what you do for the least you do for Christ?
You know what that is?
Muslim, he sure is acting like a Christian.
Well, I didn't.
What you do for the least you do for Christ? You're trying to get the rich man to pay his fair share of taxes, or Bible puts it, render to God what's God, render to Caesar what's Caesar's?
All right.
Come on, Tea Party. Stop being an obstructionist, anti-Christian group, and render to Caesar what Caesar's and pay thy taxes.
Right. Now he's judging my soul. Oh, my goodness.
The Lord.
Michael,
thank you.
Thanks for your call.
He had to get it out.
But he got it out.
Yeah, he had to
get
it out.
And he will feel good.
Yeah, he feels great.
That's good.
Yeah, judge my soul.
One of the other things, I want to talk more about it, but one of the other issues in Chicago and in many large cities around the United States, this is a gay pride weekend, really. It's become more than just a day. And yet there's been significant movement just this past week in gay rights issues. Mike, you've been covering as Indiana was thrust into the national spotlight. Where are things in the Hoosier State?
Well, right now they're kind of in flux because on Wednesday it came down a surprising federal court decision in southern Indiana legalizing same-sex marriage in Indiana. Indiana has been fighting this. And so that opened the doors for a number of same-sex couples to get wed to all over Indiana, including Northwest Indiana. But then a decision came down on Friday afternoon in the Seventh Circuit Court here in Chicago that put a stay on all this. So
what about the people who ran out and got married right away? Are they married or not married?
That's a good question. I don't even think they know.
Can they accept the presents or not? Are they going to turn them back? What's the story?
That's a good question. Hopefully we'll find out as the week goes by. But this is something, though, again, when you're talking about the Supreme Court, this is an issue that eventually they're going to have to decide.
It's going to go back there again. Absolutely. I mean, clearly the response to the Supreme Court decision, or, you know, the sending it to the states, Utah also, there was a big ruling in Utah. So, again, two more states at least where it's back on the burner. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about that and also talk about some other issues. And one of the issues on the issue of gay rights, because it's playing a role in the race for Illinois governor, and that is, should Republicans continue to battle this, or is this one of those issues that maybe at least for their long-term political stability, should they just sort of roll over and move on to other issues? 1-800-723-8029, that's the question. Your response when we come back. From Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's let all of our guests now introduce themselves with a little biographical background. And we begin with John McCarron.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. I'm a freelancer, a contributing columnist with the Chicago Tribune, where for 7 years, in fact, I'm a recovering editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune and a recovering financial editor there.
Mike Miller.
I'm Mike Miller. I'm an associate professor of economics at DePaul. I've been there since 1980 when I got my Ph.D. at the University of Pittsburgh, and I'm also an associate dean.
Mike Puente.
Michael Puente. I've been here. I've been with WBEZ for now almost 9 years, covering Northwest Indiana, South Side of Chicago. Spent 13 years in print. Most of that covering, again, Northwest Indiana with the Post Tribune. Went to Calumet College of St. Joseph in Hammond. And love journalism.
Very good. Chris Roebling.
Chris Roebling, longtime Republican activist here in Chicago, longtime friend of the program, and now I've started Clearspan Strategic LLC, a crisis communications consulting firm.
And also do work at WGN as a
WGN TV Republican analyst. That's right.
When you talked about longtime friend of the program, again, a personal note, this week marks the 34th anniversary of this broadcast. It's been a long time.
Were
you even born, Mike? Were you even born when the show went on the air?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was there.
And in thinking about it, because Chris, you've been on the show at well over 25 years, I think, probably, yeah, when we first met. You were a young man making
still
his first
am.
early appearances. And some of the other people that made their first appearances on this program include Rahm Emanuel and Carol Moseley Braun talking about national issues. And the very first broadcast, also, by, again, Jesse Jackson Jr., also one of his first broadcasts. And Congressman Luis Gutierrez, the first time he was ever on the show, had his lunch handed to him by the late, great Tom Roser, who was a regular on this program for well over 20 years. The first guests on that program included Tom Roser, who is now deceased, who used to follow us every Sunday night for many years on WLS, and the late Phil Krohn, who was a Democratic political consultant, and the other guest, who is still alive and well and very much involved in broadcasting. At that time, he was a reporter, City Hall reporter, for WMAQ, and he now is that position for WLS, and that's Bill Cameron. So those are the answers. The very first guests on the very first show, the last week in June of 1980, and I will also want to give a big thanks to this program began on WBEZ Radio. And the late, great Carol Nolan was the general manager of that station. I was doing just sort of a regular, you know, Q&A author, visiting author interview program. And I went to her one day and I said, because of what was happening politically, Ted Kennedy was challenging Jimmy Carter for the Democratic nomination. Ronald Reagan and George Bush and John Anderson were all battling it out. John Connally was in there battling it out for the Republican nomination. It was a wide open seat, at least insofar as the Republicans are concerned. And there was a lot going on. There was also a lot going on in Chicago. So I said to Carol, I said, Carol, I want to do a program that's by, for, and about political junkies. I don't want to have to stop and explain who people are. I want to get people who are not necessarily the candidates, get the people who work behind them, as if, you know, the way they're talking when they're, you know, going out for a beer and talking politics, when sometimes people that are on opposite sides, they all get together and they go out and party together because they like the same thing, politics. So the program was by, for, and about political junkies. It went on the air as Inside Politics. And also in 1989, Ken Davis, who was the program director, suggested that the program go national. So we went national. Actually, it turned out to be 1991 that we actually went national. And then a few years later, the nature of the program and the nature of politics changed. The very first national show, in opening the show with the title, it was Inside Politics, the very first national show, I referred to a beyond the beltway perspective of national politics. And a couple of years later, when the Republicans took over control of Congress, it was obviously a cataclysmic moment in American political history. On January 1st of 1974, we switched the name of the program from Inside Politics to Beyond the Beltway. But it's the same show. It's four people plus myself talking about politics each and every week in a combustible way. And a lot of at least some of the things that we talked about in the early days and the format and the way we did it has now become pretty standard fare on cable television. But again, it's been a great 34 years. Again, we look forward to the big celebration coming up next year. And the other thing is the name of the show is the philosophy of the show. I believed then, and I believe every single day and every single Sunday night when we do this program, that not all the wisdom in America resides along the banks of the Potomac River. And I think that what happens is that there's an insular nature of covering politics. And I think that those who are right of center fall into it just like those that are left of center. Their kids all go to the same schools. They all go to the same social clubs. They're afraid to maybe really embarrass, you know, other members of the party because it's the old boys network. It's an old girls network. It's some of the things that the Tea Party talks about. And this program has always meant, from the very first time it went on the air, it's always meant to be, you know, the antithesis of that. And so the name of the show is the philosophy of the show for as long as I will be here, and hopefully that's many more years. And again, we thank you very much wherever you are listening from coast to coast. We started again in public radio with syndication, and in 1992 we switched over to WLS and commercial radio, and of course many years, actually about 6 years ago now, added Sirius and XM satellite radio, and in 1996 the radio program became a television program. And for those watching us on television on WYCC, thank you for your support for many, many years. It's been a long, long time. Now,
yeah.
Back to discussion.
And David Axelrod.
David Axelrod used to be a regular.
Rahm Emanuel.
Used to be regulars.
Those were regulars. Many others.
Rahm Emanuel used to be. Here's a story. And if he's listening, he'll probably be ticked off at this. But you know what?
he gets ticked off at everything.
He hasn't,
even when you're supporting the guy.
He hasn't done the show since he's been mayor anyway, or Congress. the last time he did the show was on the eve of the NAFTA vote. With Bill Daley, and that was the last time he's done the show. But literally, he was a regular on the show for about 8 years. And when Bill Clinton came along, he would go to, he was part of the Chicago team that flew down and was part of the inner circle of Bill Clinton, and it was always officed out of and headquartered out of Little Rock. He would fly in every Thursday night. That's when the show was on. He would fly in every Thursday night to really talk about what the Clinton campaign, and mm-hmm. he could not wait. And also something he would do is periodically on a Thursday afternoon, he'd call me around 11 or 12, and he said, just to tell me something, whatever the case may be. And he said, well, who are you having on tonight? He was always fishing to be a guest on the program, and I invited him because he was a very good guest. Now, I can tell you, and again, this may make a little news. I'll tell you the people that were furious that I had Rahm Emanuel on the show, and that was Bill Daley, because Rahm Emanuel was a fundraiser for Daley, and you know, the Daleys like their people real quiet, not very talkative, and he was raising money for Rich Daley, and when he was on the program, I know every once in a while, because I would run into Bill Daley, because we were in the National Guard together a long time ago, and he was really PO'd that I had Rahm Emanuel on the show frequently, because he was just, you know, he was way too talkative for the Daley administration, and that was, but again, maybe someday Rahm will come back and do the program again.
I think so.
Because he did it for 8 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big coming of age thing for him, like it has been for so many of us.
And then he was dying to also get on. He said, because I was producing Chicago Tonight, he would just say, oh, how can you get me on Chicago Tonight? Can you get me on Chicago Tonight? I really want to be on Chicago. I want to meet John Calloway. And it was, I mean, you know, that was Rahm Emanuel. And again, Rahm, if you're watching the show tonight or you hear about this, you know it's true. We've known each other for a long time. You were at my wedding, Kathy Osterman. You were there.
Yeah.
Because, and also I will say that, that one of the other great things about that show during the period when Tom Roser was on the show for over 25 years, we would go out to dinner after every single show. And if you thought the show was great, the dinners afterwards were absolutely incredible. And one other person that that is no longer with us is Chris Bowman. Yeah. Chris Bowman was a Republican operative, and he went on to become a talk show host in Rockford, Illinois. Again, he got his start here. He died way too young, but he was one of the counterpoints to Rahm Emanuel in those days. So anyway, that's. I did a whole segment on this. I didn't mean to do it, but again, it's 34 years.
The building inspectors will be here tomorrow morning.
Election season is coming up.
I'll keep you posted. And then again, just one last thing is the time that Louis Gutierrez, who probably is the fastest mouth in the United States Congress, the first time he was ever on the show, Tom Roser absolutely ripped him apart. And when he came back about a month later, because he too was a very good guest, he absolutely handed Tom Roser his lunch, and not many people ever did.
Quite an
experience. But anyway, thank you very much again. Back to our conversation. Let's talk about, again, you were talking about gay rights and where that issue is going, and I asked the question before the break. Is this an issue that Republicans will continue to get political votes out of if they continue to sort of move and make this an important issue? Or is this, in your view, is this case law and is already closed, Chris?
I think that this is a case, this is the most startling reversal of societal attitudes that I've ever witnessed. And I think it's probably the most startling reversal of societal attitudes in American history. Mm-hmm. Because as of 2 years ago, we'd had a series of elections, a series of referenda,
right,
all over the country that all went overwhelmingly against,
right,
gay marriage. And now you just see it all flipping over.
I want to come back and talk more about that, get everybody's reaction to it when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. If you want to tweet us, it's at Dumo, D-U-M-O, or Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Sharon, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS, the boyhood home of Dan Proft from Itasca, Illinois, another one of our graduates. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a comment on the economy. I have a small service business, and the vendors where I go to, it's deceptive to buy equipment at either a restaurant supply store. I buy cleaning equipment, or at another nationwide supply area. It's very crowded with cars and trucks, but they're all loaded with mom-and-pop little businesses or sibling businesses, and these people aren't hiring anybody. You've got 2 to 5 hour, or 2 to 5 man, woman, person operations, and they're keeping it within the family. So this is how small businesses, the very, I guess you'd call them micro-businesses, are surviving. It's strange, but like your last caller who mentioned about what Christianity is, he might as well be worshiping Lucifer, because everything that the government expects us to ante up in the way of taxes, and I hear that they want to add on 12 cents per gallon on a federal tax on a gallon of gas, that would kill somebody like me in my industry, because I'm in my van all the time servicing my commercial or residential customers. We are unfortunately forced to not only pay the tax, but pay the salaries and the pensions of the people running these different government entities, and we're just swamped. And I hear this all the time from my small business associates and friends who are brave enough to want to still stay in business.
One of the great achievements, I think, of the Republican Party in our time has been to focus the anger of people such as the caller onto government. In other words, we've become a nation by and for the corporations. I mean, instead of In God We Trust, it's maximize shareholder value is really all we care about. So we send the jobs to China. We open our markets totally to other nations' exports, and when demand falls away, as demand is falling away to all these small businesses, we blame the government. And I think that's genius, and I congratulate you guys for that.
That's quite a non sequitur. I mean, she was talking about small business. The amount of small business creation during this
people
particular recovery and expansion
has been pathetic.
The research is incontrovertible. The number one generator of jobs, new jobs in this economy, are small businesses, most notably new small businesses. The reason we have not had that explosion of 300,000-400,000 per month is because small businesses have not been created because of uncertainty, because of the problems of not knowing what you're going to have in terms of costs regarding health care, with regard to regulating. Business is part of it. The fact that business is bad is part of it.
If the stores were full of buyers, they'd be hiring people. The stores aren't full of buyers. People have lost their jobs. Their jobs have been exported.
Corporations are not reinvesting in capital because they don't know what the future is going to bring. They don't know what's going to happen to tax laws. They don't know what's going to happen to costs for health care. When you look at housing, how can you have a housing recovery? Housing is way below what it was in 2007.
Let me make it this.
People don't have jobs. They don't have the money for the down payment. It's not going to happen.
I want to hear from Mike Puente. Mike, the area that you cover, Northwest Indiana, for those listening around the country, give us a little, paint us a little profile of what Northwest Indiana represents, and what are the issues that concern them the most.
Well, Northwest Indiana is a kind of very kind of a unique enclave of Indiana because it's most of Indiana is Republican. Very much Republican stronghold. Then you get into Northwest Indiana, it's very much Democratic stronghold. Their ties are very much to Chicago. Chicagoans kind of like keep Northwest Indiana at arm's length. But it's still very much a heavy manufacturing base. Still is produced in large amounts still in areas like Gary, Chicago, Portage. And then you have sort of the southern suburban areas, Crown Point, Maryville, Schererville, Valparaiso, which is very bedroom communities, upper middle class communities. But I think right there, it's sort of similar to the rest of America where you're talking about they are worrying about taxes and growing, unstable with healthcare and just all these uncertainties in terms of whether they're going to be able to hire.
What about the flood of illegal immigrants? Is that a big issue there? Is there a fear that illegal immigrants might take their jobs?
You know, not in Northwest Indiana, only because there is a kind of a significant agriculture. But as you get to more to the southern reaches of Indiana, that's where you start to get concerns. Not so much of I haven't really heard too much of as far as concerns of undocumented immigrants in Indiana.
Because once upon a time it was a very politically, even though it was blue collar and there were a lot of unions there. It was a very politically conservative area insofar as conservative Democrats. I mean, George Wallace had a huge reach, when he was running for president of the United States in Northwest Indiana.
Oh, sure. Adam Benjamin, the great congressman from Northwest Indiana. But I think that we have to look at the caller's question really in terms of how people are going to view the Senate elections in the fall and to some extent the gubernatorial. And John has his interpretation, which I agree is a non sequitur, but I know John feels it very sincerely and faithfully. I think it's wrong, and I think that the more pertinent point is that 5 years into the Obama administration, people are going to look at what they see in the economy at their level, wherever it is, and they're going to correlate that to President Obama. And I think they're going to say, if things are going well, they'll reward him. And if things are not going well, they're going to vote for a Republican for U.S. Senate or a Republican for governor. And I think that's why we're going to see an enormous shift. I think we're getting in the range of a very significant shift in the United States Senate up to sort of 53, 54 Republican senators this November. Because of the failure of the Obama administration to grow the economy.
I want to hear from you, but we do have to break for hour number one. That's John McCarron. We'll hear from him in hour number two. John McCarron and Mike Puente have been with us. Also, Mike Miller and Chris Roebling. They will all be back for the next hour if you're listening to this broadcast on radio. If you're watching us on television, we will see you next week. Or we should say, you will see us. Bye. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by John McCarron of DePaul University, Mike Miller of DePaul University, Mike Puente, reporter for WBEZ Radio, and Chris Roebling of Clear Scan Strategic LLC. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. You can go to our website, beyondthebeltway.com. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's @Dumo. And in hour number two of our broadcast this evening, we are going to do something that we've been doing quite a bit in recent months, and it's turned out to be kind of an interesting way to spend an hour of conversation with some four bright people around the table, the round table with us this evening. And it is when we let each of our guests, we have four guests, four segments, we let each of them sort of give us a bring to the table an issue that they think is has been undercovered or is stuck somewhere in the weeds, and we want to bring it out and give it some national exposure. And we will begin tonight with Mike Miller, associate. You're dean.
Associate dean and associate
DePaul
professor.
University.
Yes,
associate.
You.
And what would you like to bring for the up for the public court of public opinion tonight?
In the second term of Barack Obama, he has decided to make climate an important aspect of his term. And he's taken action. Some of them, of course, he can't take, but he is anyhow, involving raising the price of energy, stopping the Keystone pipeline, essentially, leading in a kind of a quiet way against fracking, the one ace in the hole that we could have. All these things are being done to try to raise the price of energy so that there will be less carbon put into the air, because 100 years from now, then we will keep the temperatures under control. Now, I just wanted a little bit of an aside light here. Let's assume I'm an economist, and I tell you that I want you to give me all of your money, and I'm going to invest that money for you. And I have a model of the economy, and it's going to be used to predict where it will be in 20, 30, 40, 75 years. And I want you to give me all your money to me. What would be the first thing that you would ask me in terms of this model that predicts where the market will be? How well has it
John
done,
McCarron.
Right?
I'd want to know how you're going to invest the money.
Yes, how you're going to – but the model is going to tell me that because of this model, which it's settled, I can predict the stock market 50 years out, 60 years out, so I want you to give me your money. What would be the first thing you would ask me? You would ask me to see the results, say, over the past 34 years, and show me that you have actually been right – and forecasting the economy over the past 34 years. Now, I'm going to pass out very quickly. I know it's not good radio. But if you take a look at this graph, what we see on the graph is something very interesting. The models which predict that the temperatures are supposed to rise so many degrees within 100 years have tried to predict temperatures over the past 34 years, and they've gotten it wrong in the entire period. What you see in those graphs is that line at the top is showing what they thought temperatures would do, and the two lines at the bottom are what temperatures have actually done, which means the science might be settled that CO2 can cause warming and so forth. There's no doubt about that. But can you take such information and then make a forecast regarding the climate 100 years into the future? And what these models show, you can't even do it looking backwards. You can't even forecast what the temperature would be in the 80s or the 90s and in the past decade with models that are supposed to tell us where things will be in 100 years. You would never give me your money to invest for the next 10 years if I had such a record. So my question to so many, I've asked some of my colleagues, and they just look at me dumbfounded. I understand the science is settled, but the forecasting is not settled. Why should the president stand in the way of cheap energy, which is one of the best ways to get out of poverty, based upon a theory a forecasting model which is so seriously flawed. I don't understand why you would do that.
I wasn't aware that he was standing in the way.
All this has to do with global warming. He says that those of us who don't believe in the global warming forecasting model going out 100 years, that we're flat earthers, fools.
I think the Obama administration, a week ago, authorized the export of some forms of distilled oil. I think it was a Republican governor of the state of Nebraska who originally held up the Keystone Pipeline, which, by the way, I think the president ultimately and his administration will approve of.
Really?
After the election, politically.
Yeah, after the election. Exactly. And, of course, he asked the State Department do three studies to make sure it's okay. All three studies came back and said, it's fine. There's no problem. And he still won't.
Do you know what the Ogallala Aquifer is?
I know what it is.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
What is it?
I know what it is.
Well, it's an enormous underground reservoir of potable water that's used throughout the
plains states,
you know, Kansas, Nebraska.
How is it related to global warming?
The Republican governor of Nebraska was concerned that if there were a spill on the Keystone Pipeline, that it would infiltrate down and potentially ruin the Ogallala Aquifer.
Is climate change, is that a hot political issue for Republicans?
No, it's not. I mean, I think opposition to irrational government policies that are based on faulty forecasting emanating from the, as Mike says, the scientific evidence that, you know, more carbon would tend to increase mean surface temperatures, that is a very big area for Republicans, especially.
But there's a lot of areas of this country, and I would think that Northwest Indiana might be one of them. Again, although it is strongly Democratic, it would seem to me that there isn't necessarily a groundswell. I don't think of Northwest Indiana as a place for environmental thinking. Is that a safe bet? Because they're thinking more of the jobs.
Absolutely. Indiana, actually, as a whole, as a state. I mean, right now they've come out really against some of the proposals for CO2 and for the use of coal, basically. Indiana gets most of its electricity from coal, and with some of the requirements that they want to put in to 2020, they're very opposed to it. So it's a big issue.
In Indiana and Illinois and Kentucky, you have Illinois Basin Coal.
Yes.
And Illinois Basin Coal has become very popular in Europe, especially in Germany, since the German government decided sort of willy-nilly to shut down their nuclear reactors. And one of the very few inputs that they have to balance out their reliance on Russia and Russian natural gas is Illinois Basin Coal that is shipped out of Burns Harbor. So you've seen an enormous uptick in activity at Burns Harbor, Indiana, shipping coal back over to Europe. But I think regular people who will decide all of these elections in November are more concerned about the price of fuel at their gas pump.
Exactly right, and they're going to raise the price of fuel and as one way of getting you to buy less gasoline because it won't add to the pollution called CO2.
Exactly.
This is preposterous.
The Obama administration is really a running dog for radical environmentalism that is prepared to tax to the max and limit economic growth.
That is segment number one. When we come back, Mike Puente is going to be up, and we'll find out what soapbox he jumps on. From Terre Haute, Indiana to Chicago, Illinois, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. And Mike Puente from WBEZ Radio, which is the public radio station in Chicago, has been covering Northwest Indiana for many, many years. It's now your turn to step up on the soapbox and give us a topic that you think has been undercovered undercovered by the media?
Well, it's been getting a little bit more coverage as of late. I don't know how many people here are sports fans or soccer fans. World Cup is going on right now. I can't say I'm the biggest sport, you know, soccer fan here, but, you know, I've been looking at the World Cup, paying attention to what the U.S. is doing. They play again on Tuesday. Saw the Mexican game today. They lost, kind of an upset. Big, incredible, exciting match. So it's soccer seems to be growing. And there was a column that came out early in the week by Ann Coulter who talks about it being sort of a liberal conspiracy, and that any growing interest in soccer can only be a sign of the nation's moral decay. I mean, have we gotten to this point
What was your point?
About the
fun.
World Cup.
Come on.
Is it having fun or is it just
totally
having fun? Yeah, she said it's the thing that everybody in America loves to hate, right? That's essentially what she said.
It seems like she was kind of putting it again on recent immigrants. I mean, is it just something that we can just, like, have fun watching the World Cup and rooting for a team without making it politics?
You seem to be denying your premise here.
No, I guess satire. Usually I hope that we would all know what satire is, right?
Yeah, come on.
Chris Roebling, what's your –
Well, I mean, there is always that small group of folks out there who didn't know how to understand Mike Royko. And one of the greatest things that ever happened when Mike Royko went to his vast reward, about 3 days later, Bruce Stold, and I bet, John, I bet you recall this, he published one of the best things. He could have gotten a Pulitzer just for this one item. Bruce Stold, the editorial page editor of the Chicago Tribune and a Pulitzer recipient himself, published a column entitled "For Those Who Never Got the Point." Remember that? And it was an explanation of satire in the hands of a master like Mike Royko. Now, Ann Coulter, I knew Mike Royko, Ann Coulter is not Mike. But this is meant entirely in fun.
But go ahead.
Just the way that Mike Royko used to attack Indiana.
Right. But just in terms of Ann Coulter, not making it an Ann Coulter issue, is the fact that soccer seems to be growing in popularity. Yeah. Is it a sign of anything?
But the point is, it's popular every 4 years. It's not like it's popular everywhere.
Well, but 18 million viewers of one of the key games on ESPN within the last week, and I forget, I don't know if that was U.S. Germany or whoever it was, but that says that soccer has gotten to a new plateau, and that's because all these kids who grew up playing soccer instead of football. Yeah. Are beginning to get to adulthood.
This is the master segue now. Speaking of kids and speaking of playing soccer, a lot of kids who play soccer are in Mexico and in Central America, and a lot of those young minors are fleeing to the United States, and it is creating a huge problem for our border states. You've covered also the immigration issue as well, and you're Mexican-American.
Yes.
How devastating is that issue as you see it? And has the Obama administration either directly or inadvertently created a magnet which sends a signal to those living in, primarily in Central America and Mexico, come to the United States, we'll take care of you?
I'm not sure if he created it. I know there are some circumstances where he may have, in the past, allowed certain undocumented immigrants to stay in the country. I think it's just still the overall issue of undocumented immigrants and immigration reform. I mean, just this past week, I think Congressman Luis Gutierrez did say that he was dropping it, that it's dead, it's not going to happen this year. I think it's just that overall issue that this is something that continues to go on, and that unless there is some kind of resolution to it, countries in like Mexico and in Central America, they're going to continue to send children and people across the border.
But doesn't this underscore the main principle of Republican opposition to immigration reform? And that is, you must secure the borders. And this is, even though I've said in this program, the record of deportations and stopping illegal immigrants has been an improving record over the last 5 years. But now everyone is being overwhelmed and overrun by this new group of young minors that are coming to the United States, and they're harder to deal with. And it's created a true mess. because they think once they make it to the United States, they're on the dole somewhere.
I think that this is absolutely underreported. I think that this has been ignored by the mainstream media. I think it is a signal failure of the Obama administration. I think that the Obama administration has had some successes in this area, but the fact is it doesn't care about the border, and the fact is this is utterly political on their side. And President Obama said things that encouraged people to transmit these children here, and it's gotten to the point where it's almost a Mariel Boatlift situation. I mean, when you look at the numbers of the early Mariel Boatlift in 1979, if memory serves, in May, June 79, we are talking about numbers that are beginning to approach that level. And the Mariel Boatlift, for a variety of reasons, principally Cuba and water and, you know, the courage it took these people to cross that situation, it was national news for weeks on end. This story has been suppressed by the national media because it is not convenient, and it is another story that will hurt Democratic candidates in the fall.
John McCarron.
Yeah, we all get together in our newsrooms in secret meetings, and we decide to support the president. Yeah, right, Chris.
Let's take that comment aside. Do you believe that this issue has received significant or as significant coverage as it may warrant?
It is in the media that I read, but I hasten to add that, Bruce, immigration, legal immigration, has been a godsend to this country. Otherwise, we go the way of Japan.
I agree with it.
The birth rates among native-borns are...
a straw person. There's nobody saying differently.
We're not saying that's not the case.
There's a huge amount of upheaval.
But in this particular case, it appears that minors are flooding the borders.
There's a huge amount of upheaval going on in Central America between the drugs and the opposition violence and whatnot.
And the bad policies.
My understanding that they do not meet the criterion used to determine who's a refugee.
Let's go to Bonnie. Bonnie, listening to us in Northwest Indiana. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I don't understand why the president is going to ask Congress for $2 billion to help send the children back. I don't think the Congress should give it to him because the money has already been allocated. It's called foreign aid. And I think, you know, if you're going to send children back, you should deduct it from the foreign aid that goes to those countries. And I think that will help get those countries on board, too, with preventing this.
But here's my point. What is the incentive of Mexico or a Central American country to keep those people, children, in their country when there is no job for them, no future for them? Why wouldn't those countries be encouraging people to come to the United States? Why would we trust Mexico or Central American countries to do that?
Well, because
they're glad to get rid of them.
We don't have to give them that foreign aid money that they want and they count on so bad. We can say, you know what, we were going to give you $10 million, but it costs $2 million to send these kids back, so now we're only going to give you $8 million.
Okay,
Chris Roebling.
I understand Bonnie's frustration. I want to make a very specific point, and it relates to our earlier concerns about the growth of the economy. Earlier in the Obama administration, at the end of the Bush administration, when the economy was still growing before the crash of late 2008 and went on into 2009, you had a very significant number of adults crossing that border because there was growth in this economy, there was expansion, and they could get jobs. As soon as the economy crashed, and as soon as we went through 2009 and the workout of the recession, the number of adults crossing that border, by all estimates, dropped off significantly. Why? Because they are watching how many jobs are available in the United States.
Dwindling.
They're coming here to get jobs. We understand that.
Bruce said they're coming for the dole.
No, I didn't.
Well, you said
But what happens with the kids is the kids are not coming for the jobs.
No.
The kids are not coming for jobs because they know that there aren't jobs here for kids because of child labor laws. The kids are coming for the benefits. And they're coming because Obama indicated that kids who arrive here without parental units are going to be kept here. And Jay Jamison, who is our current Secretary of Homeland Security, is still running ads in Central America that indicate if you get to the United States, you're not going to be returned. And then you talk about not covered. That is almost completely not covered. And when he's confronted about that, he says, no, those ads are actually informing people of the subtleties of American border policy, et cetera, et cetera. This thing is it's a total crisis. And I'm inclined to give the president more money here. Why? Because we have to secure that border. And when you've got kids coming over and you've got border agents who are making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you got to have another border agent who's out there watching to make sure that the Zetas and the drug lords are not crossing over.
We will be back. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, we'll hear from Chris Roebling. He's going to bring up a topic, or he can continue with the topic we're already discussing. Back shortly. Back. Thank you very much for being with us. Let me introduce our guests, or let's have them introduce themselves. And we begin with John McCarron.
Yeah, John McCarron. Thank you, Bruce. I do a little adjunct lecturing at DePaul University and some contributing of op-eds to the Chicago Tribune.
And you listen and watch this show even when you're not on it, and you respond to it with tweets and emails.
Right, especially when you are unable to take callers and you seem desperate, so I fire off an email.
That's good, and we appreciate that very much, because we were. Mike Miller.
Hi, I'm an economist from DePaul, and I've been there for 34 years. And if you ever have trouble with insomnia, write to me, and I'll send you my articles on the economy of Bahrain.
Slippery Rock University.
That's right. Slippery Rock. It was called State College at the time, 1975.
Okay. Mike Puente.
Yeah, Mike Puente here. 8 years with WBEZ, spent 13 years in print. Right now, I mostly cover everything, it seems like, south of Roosevelt Road here in Chicago, the south suburbs, south side, and Indiana.
Chris Roebling,
founder of ClearSpan. You were calling.
What did I say?
ClearScan. ClearSpan Strategic.
Span.
I know. You were kidding about it, and then you...
Then I have a mental block about it.
Anyway.
As long as it's not a scam.
Thank you. Oh, God. Yeah, I'm glad you're having fun with it tonight, okay? So, no, I think in terms of... I want to expand the conversation to other...
I'm going to do that, but we do have people that are waiting on the line. I'm going to usurp part of your time.
Go ahead.
You will yield the microphone.
Well,
Let's yield the microphone to Mike in Big Rock, Illinois, on WLS. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah, I think the woman who just called in was probably part of a group of Americans who had no problem dropping $3 trillion on two wars in the Mideast, or $1.5 billion building the Baghdad embassy in Iraq. We need to put more money strategically into Latin America and in this hemisphere to protect ourselves from events like this. Why not, when companies relocate offshore, we encourage them to relocate to Central America and give them a tax break or some compensation? We probably pour $50 million a year at the max into Central America. That's insane. That's not what's going on.
That's Mike, God bless you, but that's completely under.
What's wrong?
It's not $50 million. Prior to Baghdad, the largest embassy that was ever built in by the United States was in El Salvador. It was in San Salvador, El Salvador.
But to Mike's point,
we spend a fortune there.
Would it be a wise investment
for the United States
to spend more money down there?
The whole point here is not that we have to take government dollars and send them down there. The whole point, as we recall from the Reagan administration, one of the most enlightened bipartisan changes to the tax code was called the Caribbean Basin Initiative, the CBI. That reduced a lot of punitive tariffs relative to production in the Caribbean area and Central America. So we created a situation in which their workers were playing more on a level playing field with us. This was then reinforced by NAFTA. Okay, what we need to do, we need to be on the side of democracy and the rule of law. And instead, the Obama administration very early on decided to get on the side of Hugo Chavez and the revolutionary governments and movements in Central America that were being funded by Chavez.
In this particular case, where we have this overrunning of our borders by the miners, immigrant miners from mostly Central America.
Guatemala.
You were making the point that the southern border of Mexico is very tightly controlled.
Yes.
And you believe that Mexico is letting these immigrants into their southern border and basically a tunnel to the United States.
As long as there is a, they're making it clear that they cannot stop in Mexico. Mexico has very strict immigration laws, and they do enforce them. That's what's so galling sometimes when Mexico tries to lecture the United States about its border with Mexico.
My point was why would Mexico let Central Americans in their country? What is the mechanism to make sure that they go directly to the United States, which they can't absolutely positively control they can get across?
And they would be
fighting for the same space to get into the country that some Mexicans would have.
But there's also an issue of money being involved, money changing hands, that people will actually pay. I guess they're called coyotes who bring people over the border. Mm-hmm. And so they will actually, through corruption and so forth, they'll pay money to allow this thing to occur.
To what extent, Mike, is the influx of young, poor immigrants from Central America and Mexico, to what extent does this create an era or an expansion of potential lawlessness in many neighborhoods of the United States, including Northwest Indiana, where there may not be any other job other than maybe to be a drug runner for someone that they knew back in Mexico or Central America? And those people that are swarming to our land, you know, we would like to all think, and most liberals think, they're all here because they want to get a great job. But a percentage of those that are coming here with not very great reasons or goals in this country. They want to be involved in the drug cartel at some point.
You know, Bruce, I really don't know how much that's creating that dichotomy, even in Indiana. I know a lot of them do tend to go into the agricultural areas. But in terms of them coming just to create problems or work for the drug cartels, I gotta think that most of them aren't. They're probably just coming here because, again, that whole issue of trying to make for a better life, and I continue with this idea.
But, I mean, the drug cartel says that, don't they, John? Doesn't the drug cartel say to some, 14 or 16 or 13 year old, a kid in Mexico or in Central America, saying, listen, we want you to work for the drug cartel. We want you to be a lookout. We want you to do this. We want you, here's a gun, shoot people. I mean, is it so bizarre to think that maybe a percentage, I don't even want to put, say, even a large percentage, but a percentage of those people that are coming to this country are not coming here because they have these aspirations to be an American. They're coming here because they want to be involved in the criminal activity that is associated with some of their countrymen.
Well,
and Central America.
That may be true for a small percentage, but I think by the fact that you're throwing out these images, I really question why you're doing this. It seems to me you're trying to prejudice your audience.
No, I'm not in favor against immigration. No, I'm not because anyone that's listened to this program knows, because I've been on the border a number of times. I know there are people that come to this country and their aspiration is they want to make a better life for their family.
Yearning to be free, Bruce.
That's right. But if I am saying that I believe that many of the people that are coming to this country are coming for a very positive reason, because they want to solve their issues, and Chris just said if there's no jobs here, they are less likely to come here, why are you sort of denying the fact that there is a percentage, maybe a large percentage, I didn't say a majority, of people that would be coming here either to be on the dole or what I'm saying is involved in the criminal activity. Criminal activity exists in this country. Many of the people that are involved in criminal activity in gangs in the United States, be they black, white, or Hispanic, they're between the ages of 14 and 18 years old.
As far as
and
the
that
dole,
seems to be where this influx is coming
as
from.
As far as the dole goes, I mean, the data show that, I mean, the only dole we're talking about here is public education. That's a big number. I give you that. But there's not a lot of, AFDC or TAMF, as it's now called, participation. There's almost no, in Chicago at least, no public housing. I mean, it's a big...
What if they go into a
there's
hospital?
There's no public housing participation.
Is any one of these people turned away from a hospital if they wanted to go
no.
there?
No, never. And I don't
think... Some of them don't even go to the hospital.
No,
some
of them don't access the healthcare. I don't think folks are in touch with exactly what is going on down there. We now have something on the order of, I think, more than 55,000, perhaps more than 60,000 of these minors. And we are processing them. And we are holding them. We are feeding them. We are checking their health. We are going through all of the steps that are necessary to try
military
and
installations.
Triage. And right. We have, as Governor Rick Perry has said, all of the places that he would use for the evacuation of people from an area that is inundated by some kind of terrible hurricane off the Gulf of Mexico are now being occupied by these kids down in Texas. And I think something similar
Oklahoma
is going
as well.
On in Oklahoma and in New Mexico and in Arizona. So we are already out of pocket. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be, but what I am saying is we have to understand the emergence of this crisis and the fact that this crisis, I don't think this crisis has been on the front page of the New York Times or the LA Times. I'm not even sure it's been on the front page.
Well, you want to spin this as an Obama issue. I mean, you want to say that we're advertising to bring these folks up here. Is that your contribution to the discussion about what to do with these
kids?
I think
we have to understand how this has come to pass. This did not happen last year. It did not happen the year before. It is happening now. Both why is it happening? Why is it happening now? And what exactly is happening? And right now, the national media has put a blanket over this story. There is no ongoing reporting. It is as though this is not happening.
I hear that a lot on Beyond the Beltway, that the media is doing this, the leftist media is doing that. That's a crock, Chris.
But well, let's take a look.
It's in the paper.
Don't take it from me. Let's go to LexisNexis. Let's find it. Let's see how many times it's been on the front page of the New York Times. Let's see how many times it's been on the front page of the LA Times or the Washington Post, wherever you want to. Let's see what the AP has done with it. How many stories has the AP fed from Laredo, from El Paso? I don't think AP is out there. It's not feeding stories. We're not getting coverage. And Americans are unaware of how this crisis is beginning to impact. And folks down in Texas have said this is not just a question of caring for kids. This is a question of public health because they don't know what's going on.
We got a break.
And national security.
Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back and John McCarron. We're going to give you the last segment because you'll get your next segment because but
some
you've talked
day.
A lot. A lot. I mean, everyone has talked a lot tonight, Mike. Yeah. Not as much as everybody else. But, John, your turn. It's your segment. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you didn't tell me we were going to have to do this.
It's off the top of
so I didn't have a topic, but then Professor Miller came along with some Republican science, and it reminded me the other day of my wife, who teaches community health nursing at Loyola University here in Chicago, was saying that we're on the verge of a large measles epidemic in this country. Why are we on the verge of a disease that for which we have an effective inoculation? Well, because so many people are buying into I'd call it the Republican science, maybe
Republicans.
Republican science.
And that was a plague.
That inoculations are the cause of autism. This is big.
That's not Republican. That's liberal. That's
Jenny McCarthy.
That's the left that is doing that. There is a phenomenal send up of that about how the left has totally debased the science behind
then there's down in
inoculation.
Still my turn, Chris. Down in Texas, the legislature is appropriating money for gay aversion therapy. In other words, there's They believe there's a medical way to treat
ungay you
to ungay you. You know, so it sort of adds up. Now the professor says, "Don't worry about global warming," and I guess next week creationism. But
okay, here we go.
Right before you is evidence that the models don't predict. And you hit me with a shot like that. I'm sorry. I just don't get it. To me, you're being the one who's being unscientific. Science is a matter of looking at the data and do the models and the data agree. If the data do not agree with the model is wrong. There is no doubt about it. Even the Cosmos, Mr. Cosmos, Neil deGrasse Tyson, just had the whole thing on Cosmos. Four of the episodes, he talked about how if the data do not support the model is wrong. The data do not work. And here you take a shot at me and tell me that I'm the one who's being anti-scientific. I don't get it, John.
Well, I get a little nervous when, journalists aren't the greatest scientists, especially. I mean, a lot of us got into this business because we couldn't long divide.
Or economists either.
Economists certainly are better with the numbers, but when I'm told to ignore or discount, the National Science Foundation or the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that gives me pause. Yeah, because as a non-expert, I have to rely on the official experts, and what I'm being told here, I believe, is the official experts have it all wrong. And Professor Miller and his handout has got it right.
I don't think that's
IPCC
what he was saying.
Puts out a 5-year report. You know about the IPCC report. It just came out this past year.
And what is that?
One of the chap that's the
panel on climate
change. And the IPCC had essentially a whole chapter on how to try to explain the fact that the real world temperatures and the models don't agree. That somehow their models are failing before their eyes, and they have to try to explain how come we're wrong. At least do you have any degree of skepticism whatsoever when you see forecasts which are so dramatically wrong? Do you have even a tiny bit of skepticism about making predictions 100 years in the future about something as chaotic as climate, and then asking us today to change our lifestyle to have an effect upon an economy 100 years from now?
Well, again, I'm not an expert, but when I see time lapses of the polar ice caps disappearing or the Greenland ice sheet disappearing, that gives me real pause. And
just before I came, I was sitting. I got here early because traffic wasn't too bad, and I was going through. It was on the Drudge Report, but it was from a government report on the amount of ice in Antarctica. It is the greatest amount of ice coverage since 1979, the largest anomaly away from average since 79. The ice is growing. It's not falling. This is an unfortunate fact.
It was admitted, John, and I realize that we're all busy and we don't have time to keep up with this stuff. But, for instance, you mentioned this canard about ice, and one that has gone along with that is the polar bear issue and the fact that the polar bears were dying out. And I don't know if you know this, but 3 weeks ago, the folks who published that story publicly said they had gotten it wrong, that they had not used the right variables, that they were admitting that the polar bear scare was entirely
made up.
I don't want to say that it was made up, that it was an error, that polar bears are doing fine, and that the data that they continued to collect from the Arctic region indicated that the polar bears are okay. So I think you're a professional journalist and you've got an inbred skepticism for the handout, right? Step number one, if your mom says she loves you, go check it out. So you get the handout from the big government agency. I got that skepticism years ago. I've never lost it. And it applies for me, whether it's a Republican source or a Democratic source or a government source.
Well, he's skeptical of Mike's handout tonight.
But those are that fuzzy one at the bottom. There are something like 103 models that are used to try to predict the climate. Those are those lines going off into the future. Out of the 103, 102 are completely wrong compared to the actual real world data.
That
How could you believe that the models
was,
are good?
Let's see him again. Mike Miller, he is an associate economist at DePaul, Associate Professor at DePaul University, and Dean as well, Associate Dean. And Chris Roebling has been with us. And the name of your new company is?
Clearspan Strategic. Thank you.
And Mike Puente also joins us from WBEZ. Mike, thanks very much on your maiden voyage on our broadcast.
Thank you.
John McCarron, you always keep everybody's blood boiling, including your own. It's nice to have you with us, DePaul University and Chicago Tribune. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Todd Nebel and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.